The only piece of literature that we have that tells us how to work the steps is the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill recognizes that when he tells us in the very beginning of the 12 and 12 that it's there to give us additional information, a series of essays on the steps, so we can better work them according to the big book. He said that the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, was a basic text for AA, always has been, always will be. But there's some information in that 12 and 12 that I think is absolute marvelous information. And I'm like Joe on the first three or four pages of step four in the 12 and 12. I learn more about what makes me tick, what makes me think the way I think, what makes me act the way I act. I learn more in 4 pages of that book than I'd learned in 40 years of living before I came to AA. And he talks there about the basic instincts of life, which create self itself. And if we can see those basic instincts and see how they create self, then we can really begin to understand why we need to get rid of self-will. It also helps us in step three, and it also sets us up for step four. Because he uses the terminology of these basic instincts of life in the big book in step four, but he didn't explain them, and I don't think he could explain them at that time. But he certainly did 13 years later in the 12 and 12. There he talks about these three basic instincts of life, and he says all human beings are born with these three basic instincts of life, that they are absolutely necessary for survival of the human race. Therefore, they must be good things. He broke it down into three things. He talked about the social instinct, the security instinct, and the sex instinct. And under the social instinct, he said all human beings are born with a desire to be liked, to be accepted, to be recognized by other human beings. He said if we didn't have that desire, if we cared nothing at all about what our fellow human beings thought of us, there would be no society on earth, period. That if we cared nothing about other human beings and what they thought of us, the world would go into dog-eat-dog situation, complete anarchy would reign, and under those conditions the human race would simply fail to survive. So these desires that you and I have, to be liked, to be accepted, to be recognized by other people, they are a God-given thing, they are a good thing, they are necessary for our survival. He used several terms under that. He talked about companionship. Companionship is nothing more than wanting to belong or to be accepted by other people. How many of us, as we were kids growing up, always felt like we were on the outside of the crowd looking in, wanted to be a part of and knew we could not be, desperately wanted that recognition and acceptance from other human beings? He used the term prestige. Now, prestige is nothing more than wanting to be recognized or to be accepted as the leader of the group. And the world needs leaders. Somebody's got to make decisions. I guess even back in the old caveman days, somebody had to say, John, get behind that tree with your spear. Mary Bell, you get over behind that bush with your club. And Don and I are going to run this sucker through here, and we're going to jump him, and we're going to have something to eat. Somebody has to do that. Now, most people will take either one of two routes. Either let me be a part of, or let me be the leader of. In either case, it's going to be based upon what they think of us. If they like us and accept us and respect us, we can become those things. If they don't and they reject us, then we feel like we're on the outside of the crowd looking in. He talked about self-esteem. Self-esteem is what we think of ourselves. And that's usually high or low, based upon what other people think of us or what we think other people think of us. If they seem to like us and accept us, we feel pretty good toward ourselves. If they reject us or we think they reject us, then we feel pretty lousy toward ourselves. Pride. Oh, I'm glad I got in the habit of going to the dictionary. I used to think pride is something that you ought to have. When I was a young fella growing up, all I ever wanted to be was a man who walked tall with pride and a little bit sideways, just like John Wayne did.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I ever wanted to be. Until I looked it up in a dictionary, and the dictionary defines pride as an excessive and unjustified opinion of oneself.
Mm-hmm.
We either think too well of ourselves, we think too little of ourselves. In either case, it's not true. Personal relationships is our relations with other human beings and the world around us. Ambitions are our plans for the future to gain power, recognition, acceptance, and so forth. All things come from that social instinct which is God-given. Now, if I want to be liked and accepted and respected by the world and everybody in it, then the first thing I've got to do is decide, well, what is it that I need to do to be liked and accepted and respected? And the world teaches us those things as we grow up. And we listen to and we watch other people. And based upon what we think they want from us, then we're like the actor that wants to run the whole show. We then write a little script in our mind as to what we need to become. And we set the goal in order to become those things that we think we need to be in the future. And that will vary in different parts of the world. One part of the world is to have a good education. Another part of the world is to be a large landowner. Another part of the world, it may be to have a large family. Another part of the world, it may be to be a good businessman. It will vary in different parts of the world. And based upon what we're taught, we set our goals and we begin to work toward those goals. Now, if you're going to reach the goals you set for yourself, you can't be just a bum and sit on your duff and do nothing and reach the goals. At the same token, we're probably going to have to make some sacrifices. You know, there are some things that I would like to do as a human being that are very exciting and very pleasurable. But if I do those things and you catch me at it, you're not going to like me at all. And I don't think you and I would do the work necessary to reach the goal. Now, make the sacrifices necessary to be accepted unless we got a reward for doing so. And the great reward we get is that great feeling at the moment of successful completion of the goal. And they pat us on the back and they say, "Ah, Joe, you're a fine fellow. You're doing a great job. You're a smart man." My God, we get one of those feelings which is absolutely indescribably wonderful. But the only thing wrong with it, though, it seems to be just a temporary feeling. Hell, we no sooner reach the goal, we get the recognition, we get the power, we get the acceptance, and we look around and we say, well, is this all there is to it? And we set another goal. And we work and we work and we strive and we strive and we reach the goal and we get the recognition and the power and et cetera, and my God, it feels great, but it doesn't last very long, so we set another goal. And they're not giving it to us quite as fast as we think they ought to. We're not getting it the way we think we should, so what do? Well, we start taking shortcuts. We start doing a little lying, a little conning, a little manipulating, a little stepping on other people's toes and climbing on their backs in order to get our what we think we need. And the instant we do that, we create pain and suffering for others. This seems to create within us an insatiable desire for more and more power, more and more recognition, more and more acceptance. And in trying to get it more fast or rapidly, we end up creating pain and suffering for other people. And the instant we do that, they retaliate against us, and then they create pain and suffering for us. It's plain that a life run on self-will can hardly ever be a success, because under those conditions, we're always in collision with people, places, and things. He talked about the security instinct. And he said, all human beings are born with a desire to be secure in the future. And he said, if we didn't have that desire, we wouldn't provide the food, the clothing, the shelter, the things that we're going to need in the future. Next winter season, we would freeze to death. The next drought season, we would starve to death. Now, I know in AA, we try to live one day at a time. But I also know that everybody in this room has got an insurance policy. And the insurance policy is to protect ourselves in the future. That's a basic God-given thing, and it's normal. Now, if I want to be secure in the future, once again, I'm going to have to decide, well, what is it I need in order to be secure in the future? And once again, society teaches us these things. As we grow up, we listen to others, we watch what they do, and we start determining what we need in order to be secure in the future. It'll vary in different parts of the world. One part of the world is $4. Another part of the world is $4,000. Another part of the world is $4 million. Another part of the world is 192 coconuts. Whatever it is that they use to measure, trade, and barter with. And based upon what we're taught, we set our goals. And we start working toward that goal. Now, if you're going to be secure in the future, you can't just sit on your duff and have nothing and be secure in the future. By the same token, we're going to have to make sacrifices. We can't blow everything we've got today if we want to be secure in the future. We're going to have to work, we're going to have to save, we're going to have to invest, and etc. And I don't think you and I would do the work necessary to make the sacrifices necessary to be secure in the future if we didn't get a reward for doing so. And the great reward comes at the moment of successful completion of the goal. My God, how many of us have done it? We started out for a new bicycle. We started out for a new dress. We started out for a new pair of shoes, for new drapes, for a new home, for a new automobile, for a new business. And we work and we work and we work and we strive and we strive and we strive. And the day that sucker becomes ours, nobody can take it away from us. My God, what a great feeling that is. You know, when I was a kid growing up, hardly anybody owned their own home. Just a very, very few of the elite owned their own home. And once in a while, somebody would scrape enough money together to make a down payment on a little bitty house. And they would pay, and they would pay, and they would pay, and they would pay. And the day they got that sucker paid off, they threw a party. They called in all the neighbors. And we celebrated by burning the mortgage. What a great feeling that actually was. The only thing wrong with it, though, is just a temporary feeling. Hell, you no sooner get that sucker paid for than you look around, well, hell, her house is bigger than mine. Now, this guy's in a Brooks Brothers suit, and I bought mine at Kmart's. He's driving a Cadillac, and I'm still in a Chevrolet. And that caused us to set a new goal. And we work, and we work, and we strive, and we strive, and we reach the goal. It feels great, a good feeling, but it doesn't last very long, and we set another goal. It seems to create within we human beings an insatiable desire for more and more and more and more and more of these things. They're not giving them to us fast enough. We're not getting them the way we think we ought to. So what do we do about that? Well, we take shortcuts. We lie. We cheat. We con. We manipulate. We steal. The instant we do those things, we create pain and suffering for other people. They, in turn, retaliate against us and create pain and suffering for us. Plain little life run on self-will can hardly ever be a success. Under those conditions, we're always in collision with people, places, and things. The last thing he talks about is the sex instinct.
Better get you a drink of water on that.
Better have me a drink of water for us, Tom.
He gets excited when he starts talking about this.
He said all human beings are born to the desire for sex. Now, it may get turned off by bad teachings or by bad happenings. But he said, all human beings are born with a desire to have sex because if we don't have sex, we cannot reproduce ourselves. And if we don't reproduce ourselves, then sooner or later, the human race is going to fail to survive. Now, if you're going to reproduce yourself through the sexual act, it's just like the other two instincts, you're going to have to work at it. Hell, you can do more work in 3 minutes of sex than you'll do all day digging a ditch. Don't you older guys remember how it used to be when you got through with it? My God, you fell over sideways. The sweat's just pouring off of you. You can hardly get your breath. You feel like you've died, gone to heaven, and come back two or three times. And I don't think we would do that kind of work if we didn't get a reward for doing so. The great reward we get is at the moment of successful completion of the sex act. We get one of those feelings, both mentally and physically, which is absolutely indescribably wonderful. Never been anything like it before, probably never been anything like it in the future. But also, just exactly like those other two things, it's just a temporary feeling. Hell, you no sooner get through with doing it than you get to thinking about doing it again. And it's such a pleasurable and such an exciting thing. The next thing you know, we get to thinking about doing it with different people. We get to thinking about doing it in different ways. We get to thinking about doing it in different positions. And the next thing you know, we're doing it at the wrong time with the wrong people in the wrong way. The instant we do that, we create pain and suffering for others. Playing the life of our own self-will can hardly ever be a success. Because when we hurt others through the sexual act, they're going to retaliate against us and create pain and suffering for us. So these three basic instincts of life that really determines the things that we do are God-given, they're absolutely necessary for the survival of the human race. The only problem is, all human beings have them. All human beings have self-will. All human beings will overdo at one time or another in these three basic instincts of life, one way or another, and all human beings will be thrown in collision with the world and everybody in it. Bill tells us in the 12 and 12 that every emotional problem a human being can have will stem from one of these three basic instincts of life. He said, because of those things, running on self-will, we absolutely cannot keep from harming other people. Now, if we could all fulfill these three basic instincts at the level that God intended, then there would be no conflict in the world today. Everybody would be in perfect peace and harmony with each other. Now, if you'll notice, coming out of those three basic instincts of life, a little circle called self. That's what makes up self-will. Those basic instincts of life. Trying to fulfill those things. Coming out of self, you'll notice another little circle called wrongs. It's another word you have to look at. Somewhere in AA, we got the idea that wrongs was a list of dirty, filthy, nasty items. But if you go to the dictionary and look it up, you'll find several definitions for it. One definition of the word wrong is feelings of bitter hurt or indignation, which comes from rightly or wrongly held feelings of being injured or offended by other people. And that's exactly what a resentment is. Unjustified opinions and feelings of other people. Another definition of the word wrong is fear. You know, every alcoholic that I know is absolutely filled with fear. Fear we're going to lose what we got, fear we're not going to get what we want, fear what other people think of us, and etc. Another definition of the word wrong is the harms and the hurts that we do to other people because of these basic instincts of life. You know, we're not bums. We have a conscience. And the fear of what they're going to do when they catch us, the guilt and remorse associated with those things, absolutely eat us up. It's very, very easy to spot a selfish, self-centered human being. They will always display three common manifestations of self. A selfish, self-centered human being is always madder than hell. Damn her and damn them and by God they'll not do me that way and I'll show them and I'll get even with those SOBs. A selfish, self-centered human being is always scared to death. Afraid we're going to lose what we got. Afraid we're not going to get what we want. Afraid what other people think of us, and etc. A selfish, self-centered human being is always doing things based on self that creates harms and hurts for other human beings. Now, a mind that is filled with resentment, a mind that is filled with fear, a mind that is filled with guilt and remorse does not feel good. And we'll run around under those conditions just long enough. And the mind wanting to feel better, and the mind begins to think about that thing that's always made us feel better, that great sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a couple of drinks. Next thing you know, we con ourselves into believing we can drink. And we go back and we take the drink, and that triggers the allergy, and we end up drunk and sick all over again. So evidently, if I want the necessary peace of mind, serenity, and happiness for a good future life, I'm going to have to start trying to do something about self-will. Get on God's will. And on God's will, then I'm no longer in conflict with other people, places, and things. I'm no longer filled with resentment, fear, and guilt, and remorse. And I might be able to stay sober, Joe.
Okay, so we see that the first requirement is that we be convinced in any life our own self-will could hardly be a success. And then Bill goes into some explanations. He tells us why it won't work. He told us earlier how it works. Now he tells us why it won't work because of selfishness and self-centeredness. He gives us some illustrations here of why we try to make people mind and they won't mind. And on page 62, he gives us some more information as to why it won't work. And it said selfishness and self-centeredness. That, we think, is the root of our troubles. And we're driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation. But we invariably find that sometime in the past, we have made decisions based on self, which later put us in a position to be hurt.
Would you repeat that last sentence, please?
Alcoholism. I, self, and me. But we invariably find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based upon the satisfaction of these basic instincts of life that Charlie just talked about, which later put us in a position to be hurt. I want what I want when I want it, seems to be the rallying cry for most of us alcoholics. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us, and God makes that possible. Can't heal a sick mind with a sick mind. We've got to have God's help. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without His aid. Many of us have moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them even though we would like to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help.
One of the greatest mistakes we see people making in AA today is we try to make ourselves better. We try to overcome self with self. We absolutely cannot do that. The only thing that's powerful enough to overcome self is the power that made it in the first place, which is God as we understand it. There seems to be no way of entirely getting rid of self left on our own resources. As Joel is fond of saying, a sick mind cannot heal a sick mind. This power is going to have to come from some source other than our own minds.
I had a friend of mine used to always say, getting self can't get rid of self. No, no. It's like a monkey trying to get rid of bubble gum. It sticks to his hand. Okay. All people have, he talks about all people have this. We're not freaks. It's like every human being has self-will. It's a God-given thing, so therefore it's good. All people have problems with it. But he's real careful to say, we alcoholics have a self-will run riot.
Extreme.
We got a bad case of it.
That might be an understatement.
Yeah, it might be. Yeah. So our struggles, we think, they arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of a self-will run riot. He doesn't think so. Above everything, the alcoholic must be rid of selfishness. And he tells us down here how the only way we know to get rid of self. Now, if you're having a problem, obviously, with self-will, then the only thing that could correct self-will would be God's will. That's the only other will that exists. You can't take it to the wheel shop down the corner. Seeing Robux in places like that. God made it. God is the only one to correct a force like this. It's a powerful force. We have a powerful force within us. No human can control it. It causes all human problems. Only God can control a force like that. So next we decided here after the grandma life, God was going to be our director.
First he said, This is the how and why of it.
Yeah.
First of all, we had to quit playing God.
Yeah, okay.
Now everything I read makes me believe that this is a God-directed world.
Right.
And those of us who have been self-directed, those of us who have been trying to direct everything and everybody around us, we've been trying to do God's work for Him.
Playing God.
We're not God.
Playing.
We just been playing at being God. We're going to have to quit doing it because it does not work. It's obvious, especially for we alcoholics that have contrived to control everything and everybody in our entire lifetime. The situation got worse and worse and worse and worse. By trying to play God, by trying to direct everything and everybody, including ourselves, we just got sicker and sicker and sicker and sicker. It did not work.
I was going to be our director. As the word, he changed, and I suggest you, my director.
He got his word right back in now.
Put it right back in. He put director. Put director right back. They made him take it out, but he put it right back. He is the principal. We are his agent. He is the father. We are his children. Most good ideas are simple, but this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch to which we passed freedom. Now he's looking at back to his design, the little picture he painted. When he said step one was the foundation, willingness was the foundation, and step one is willingness. Believing was the cornerstone. Now he's telling us we're going to build an arch through which we pass to freedom. We're building an arch. And step three is the keystone of this arch. Now the keystone is the stone in the very top that holds all the other stones together. So he's telling us step three is the supporting stone of these steps we're taking. And it gives us a little picture as we go along of the progress we're making. So we're building an arch, a spiritual experience, which we're going to pass through the freedom from alcohol.
And we like to emphasize that we don't have to wait till step 12 to start getting something out of this. This wonderfully effective spiritual structure that we're building is personality change sufficient to bring out recovery from alcoholism. Is already beginning to take place. And we didn't get much out of step one. We didn't get much out of step two. Those were just information steps, conclusions of the mind. But now then, as we begin into step three, we begin to get some results. The personality now begins to change. Joe, page 63.
I love this part of the book, and it says that he is the principal, we're the agents. He's the father, we're the children. Most good ideas are simple, and I almost missed that because I use God like he would an errand boy. God, please get me sober. God, please get my wife back. God, help me make some more money. You go out and do all them things, you know, using like an errand boy. And after I got sober around for a while, I got to reading another big book. And in front of that book, he said that he worked for 6 days and then he rested. To my knowledge, he'd never go back to work anymore. It looks to me like there's going to be any work being done around here. It's going to be me. He's the father. We're the children. He's the boss. I work for him. Most good ideas are simple. And I almost missed that.
Now listen very carefully. Yeah.
So now on top of page 63. When we sincerely took such a position, the one he just described, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. I thought he was going to do my work well. I'd do his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. See, I've always been a taker. I want to see what I can contribute. Takers are losers, not only in AA, but everywhere. I want to see what I can contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of His presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. And I tell you, that idea about being reborn used to make me just, my hair on the back of my neck would stand up when people talk about it. There was a little church up the road from where I lived, and on Monday night they used to come over to my house and knock on the door and want to talk to me about being reborn. I'm sitting there drinking, getting ready to watch Monday Night Football. And man, I'd run those people out of there. Get out of here. Get out of here. I don't even want to talk to you about this stuff. You see, and then Joe helped me with this years later. He told me a story about Nicodemus. And Nicodemus was just like me, dumber than a rock. Because he went to this guy who was talking about being reborn, and he said, what do you mean by that? I don't understand. You mean I've got to go back into my mother's womb and be reborn? And I can just see him shaking his head. And he said, Nicodemus, didn't you go to the university? Aren't you educated? Don't you know you can't do that? When I talk to you about being reborn, I'm talking about the renewing of your mind. Old ideas cast aside, and new ones accepted.
Personality change, sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism.
Mm-hmm. Now I could understand this. See, I could go for that. And so, I know I wanted to turn my will and my life over to the care of God at that little church. I don't know why I did that, but I did. This is just what I did. And I went down there on Sunday morning. And I knew what they did on Sunday morning, about 2 or 3 minutes before 11. But they're still doing it. And I went down there about 2 or 3 minutes before 11. Didn't want to get there too early. I might hear something that would help me, you see. So I got there, and sure enough, they asked people to come down there and basically do the third step prayer. That's what they were asking me to do. So I went down there, and the book says we were now at step three. Now we're ready to do business. It said, many of us said to our makers, we understood him. God, I offer myself to you to build with me and to do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondages of self, that I may better do your will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those that I would help of your power, your love, and your way of life. May I do your will always. And I was sincere and honest and humble as I have ever been in all of my life. I wanted this prayer to happen in my life. I pray this prayer today every time I think about it, because I truly want God's will to be done in my life. Now, I don't know what happened that Sunday morning way back then, but I do know this. Looking from then until today, my life hasn't been the same. I have been reborn. I am not what I used to be, thank God. Well, I'm very, very lucky, because you would not have liked me a long time ago, because I was not a very nice person. And I hurt a lot of people, physically and mentally and emotionally in a lot of ways. Went to prison for some of that. So, thank God I'm not what I used to be. I am been reborn, not in my body, but in my mind. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which used to be the guiding force of my life, are gone. And a whole new set of motives begin to dominate me from that moment to this.
We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to Him. I think utterly means completely, wholeheartedly, the whole ball of wax. I hope you don't make the mistake I did first time I took step three. I got down on my knees, which I very seldom did in those days. I said, God, I offer myself to thee to deal with me and do with me as thou will. Relieve me of the bondage of self, so on, so on, so forth. And as I finished it up, I said, now this applies to my alcohol. Don't fool with my sex life. And I believe I can handle the money too.
God probably said, what an order. I can't go through with it.
I said, you take the alcohol and I'll take care of the rest. And today I realize the complete fallacy, and that is that God don't want the alcohol.
Yeah.
Of course, I know God probably doesn't even drink. What He wants me is me, all of me, period. Now just think, if God could direct my thinking in all areas, not only would I be able to live without alcohol, but my sex life might get better too. My economic life might get better also. Well, I might get better in all areas if God directs my entire thinking. We found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person, such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. It's long been known that prayer, taken in the company of other human beings, has a deeper and a more lasting effect than prayer taken alone. The book's going to refer to it later on, that we are tridimensional creatures. We're meant to live with God, ourselves, and other human beings. And we're praying in company with another human being. We're beginning to fit ourselves back as God intended for us to be in the first place. And way back in the beginning in Dr. Bob's house, when it came time for the new alcoholic to make the surrender, They took this new person upstairs into one of the bedrooms. Four or five of them got together and got on their knees. And this new person made their surrender our decision today. And after he had made his decision, made his surrender, the older members would vote on how well he did it. If he didn't do it good enough, they'd make him do it again later on. They always took it in the company of other human beings. Now, I'm going to ask you to do a favor for me. Just a favor for me personally. If you don't want to do this, you don't have to. But what I'd like for you to do is reach out and hold hands with the people on each side of you. It's only going to take us a minute. And then I'd like for you to repeat after me. God, I offer myself to thee.
God, I offer myself to thee.
To build with me and do with me as thou wilt.
To build with me and do with me as thou wilt.
Relieve me of the bondage of self.
Relieve me of the bondage of self.
That I may better do thy will.
That I may better do thy will.
Take away my difficulties.
Take away my difficulties.
That victory over them may bear witness.
That victory over them may bear witness.
To those I would help of thy power.
To those that I would help of thy power.
Thy love.
Thy love.
And thy way of life.
And thy way of life.
May I do thy will always.
May I do thy will always.
You'll never have to worry about whether you've taken step three or not. You just did it. Thank you all for being here. See you later. Joe, and Carly. Hi again, my name is Charlie Parman. I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic.
Thank you, Glenn.
You all having a good time? Are you enjoying the big book study? The 12 and 12?
Yeah.
A little history about the big book and Alcoholics Anonymous. Isn't it great? I'm going to start off with a little joke again this time. We're going to get real serious after a while, so we better get the humor started now. And I'm going to tell a little story about an alcoholic, an Al-Anon, and an Alateen. By the way, do we have any Al-Anons in here? Could I see your hands? Yeah, we got some. Okay. All right. This alcoholic, the Al-Anon, the Alateen had been to an AA convention. On the way home, they decided they would go back a different route, take a route through the country so they'd be able to see a little of the countryside on the way back. And they got way out in the country, and sure enough, they got lost. And they tried and tried and tried to find their way out, and finally gave up. Went to the old farmer's house, knocked on the door. Farmer came to the door. They told him what the situation was and asked for directions. He said, well, it's pretty easy for you to get out of here. It's not all that difficult. But he said, I'll tell you what, it's getting so close to dark. You're probably going to get lost again, even if I give you directions. He said, why don't you guys just spend the night here with us? You can get up in the morning and go home, and you won't have any trouble. And they said, oh, well, great, that would be fine. So they all go in the house, and they're sitting around talking, and the farmer said, now, we've only really got one problem. He said, I can only sleep two of you here in the house. One of you will need to go down in the barn and sleep with the animals. The little Alateen said, oh, that's great. Let me go down there. He said, I love animals and they love me and I won't have any trouble down there at all. So they all went to bed with the Alateen down in the barn. In about an hour, knock on the front door. Farmer goes to the door and there stands the Alateen. He said, man, I can't sleep down there. He said, the pigs are grunting, the cows are mooing, the horses are stomping their feet, and the chickens are clucking, and I just can't sleep. The alcoholic said, okay, come on inside and go to bed. I'll go down in the barn. I'll sleep with the animals. I was raised on a farm. That'll be no problem for me. So they all go to bed with the alcoholic down in the barn. In about an hour, knock on the front door. Farmer goes to the door, and there stands the alcoholic. He said, man, I can't sleep down there either. He said, the pigs are grunting, the cows are mooing, the horses are stomping their feet, and the chickens are clucking. I just can't sleep. The Al-Anon said, well, all right. Said, come on in. I knew it would be up to me to handle the situation. He said, you guys go to bed, and I'll go down to the barn, and I'll sleep with the animals. So they all went to bed with the Al-Anon down in the barn with the animals, and sure enough, in about an hour, knock on the door. Farmer goes to the door, and there stands the pigs and the cows and the chickens. Every time I tell that, my wife Barbara really gets upset when I tell that. Okay, we've done a lot of work in the Big Book up to this point. We've been able to see what our problem is. We've been able to see what the solution is. We've been able to make a decision regarding that solution. And we've actually taken steps 1, 2, and 3. Now, no great big changes have happened through these 3 steps because there's not a whole lot of action involved in them. Step 1 was just a conclusion of the mind. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, our lives unmanageable. Step 2 is a conclusion of the mind. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step 3 is but a decision. And the only action involved in step 3 is when we did the step 3 prayer together. But we've now got 1, 2, and 3 behind us. And now we're ready to get on with the rest of the program. So let's go to the bottom.
Page 63.
And let's start looking at the program of action. Joe?
So the first word is next. She tells us what to do next. Right after 3, we do this next. Next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted. Though our decision,
step 3,
was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. And remember again, back on page 45, it said the main object of this book was to enable me to find a power greater than myself which would solve my problem. And we're going to start looking at those things which has been blocking us off from the decision that we just made.
So the first thing we like to look at is the time element between step 3 and step 4. And you hear this question asked throughout AA all over the world. How long should you wait to do step 4 after you have taken step 3? And we hear all kind of answers. Some people say, well, you probably ought to wait at least 30 days. Some others say, well, you probably ought to wait at least 90 days. Others may say, well, you probably ought to wait at least 6 months. We heard a professional in the field counseling people to wait a minimum of 2 years. And our question to that counselor was, how many people have you killed with that statement?
Mm-hmm.
You see, what we're trying to do is find a way to live. Where not only can we be sober, but we can be peaceful and happy and free at the same time, so that we can have good long-term sobriety. And every day that we put off on step 4, it's another day we remain restless, irritable, and discontented. Another day we stay filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. And sooner or later, under those conditions, our mind, in seeking relief, will begin to think about that great sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a couple of drinks. Next thing you know, we become insane, and we end up thinking we can drink, and we end up drunk all over again. I really don't know how long I could go between step 3 and step 4 before I ended up drunk. And frankly, I'm not very interested in finding out. The Big Book tells us when we should take step 4. It says step 3 is going to have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of those things in ourselves which have been blocking us. And I think when he said at once, he meant right now. So we believe that the Big Book is telling us we should get on with step 4 just as soon as we finish up with step 3. And that does make sense, doesn't it? For as I know, 4 is always followed exactly after step 3. And if we don't do that, after a while, Our mind is going to begin to say, well, we really don't need to take step four. Or fear is going to keep us from taking step four. And then sooner or later we say, to hell with it. And we end up getting drunk all over again. So we believe we ought to go into step four as soon as we finish up with step three. Now, why don't we do that? Knowing full well that we might get drunk if we don't do that. Then why would we continue to procrastinate on step four? I think probably two or three reasons. Number one, I think many of the old-timers tend to play king off of the mountain with a newcomer when it comes to step four. And we tell him how hard it is. By God, you just wait till you get to step four. Yada, 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 yada. And we just literally scare them to death with it. Let us be the first to say today, tonight, if we do step four the way the big book says to do it, there is absolutely nothing to be afraid of. And I think in a little while we're going to be able to see that. Another reason I think we tend to procrastinate on step four is for years we didn't understand how to do it. Not understanding how Bill writes. Not understanding how he likes to use examples of something we already know to teach us something new. We saw him do that when he talked about the great ocean liner. The moment after rescue from shipwreck, he knew that he could use that example and people would understand what he was trying to teach us. Not understanding that Bill did not like to use the same words over and over. And he always found a different word when he wanted to repeat himself. Not understanding those things, we simply could not understand how to do step four according to the big book. The instructions are here. They're on page 64. But they are so short and so sweet that we simply overlooked them and didn't understand how to do it. So therefore, we went into step five. And we saw something that said something about sharing all your life story. And we said, oh, that's what they wanted us to do in step four, was write our life story. And that's the way many of us did it way back in the beginning. Now, I don't know whether my life story was very important to other people, but it must have been to me, because when I wrote it, I had 92 pages in it. I took it to another poor, suffering alcoholic, and he read it, and when he got through with it, he said, that's not very pretty, is it? And I said, no, it isn't. He said, you'll never have to be that way again. And he threw it in the waste paper basket, and I learned nothing to contribute to my alcoholism by the writing of my life story. As I look back at it tonight, I fully realize 95% of my life story has nothing to do with my alcoholism anyhow. The fact that I was born in 1929, I don't think it's got a thing to do with my alcoholism. It may have had something to do with somebody else's alcoholism, but not mine. The fact that I graduated from high school at age 17 went immediately into the service. I don't think that had a thing to do with my alcoholism. The fact that I was married at age 21, I don't think that's had a thing to do with my alcoholism. But I tell you what it did. The 95% that had nothing to do with it very effectively covered up the 5% that did have something to do with it. And I learned nothing to contribute to my alcoholism from the writing of my life story. So in our desperation, somebody in Minneapolis, Minnesota, wrote a four-step inventory guide. And we took the Minnesota guide and we combined it with the big book, and we got more confused yet. Somebody in Dallas, Texas, wrote a four-step inventory guide. We took the Dallas guide, we combined it with the Minneapolis guide, we combined it with the big book, and we got more confused yet. I have no idea how many inventory guides are floating around out there today. We saw one time that had 20 pages in it. And I'll guarantee you, if you wasn't crazy as hell before you took it, you would be before you were through with this one. It was one of those kinds. And all the time, the instructions had been right here on page 64. And we just couldn't see them. But finally, when we realized how Bill writes, the things that he does, the rhythm of his writing, we began to understand what he wanted us to do. So tonight, let's just kind of relax and take it easy. We'll look at a few words and a few instructions. And I think we're going to be able to see that step four, not only is there nothing to be afraid of, but it is also a very simple procedure if we do it according to the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. Joe?
Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke.
Now, this is his first comparison. Comparing between a business inventory and our personal inventory. You know, if you had a business and you did an inventory in there once in a while, you wouldn't have any idea where you stand. And I don't care what the business is, whether it's selling ladies' purses, men's watches, bicycles, or whatever. If you did an inventory once in a while, and by the way, an inventory is defined as a written list of items. And if you did an inventory once in a while, you wouldn't know what's been sold out of your store. And after a while, you would end up with empty shelves and empty floor spaces with nothing to sell. If you did an inventory once in a while, you wouldn't know what's been stolen that you didn't get paid for. If you did an inventory once in a while, you wouldn't know what's become out of style. Nobody really wants to buy it. You need to put it on sale so you can get rid of it. If you did an inventory once in a while, you wouldn't know what's become damaged and unsaleable. Nobody wants to buy it. It's sitting there in your store taking up very valuable shelf space, very valuable floor space. You're probably paying interest on borrowed money to put it in there in the first place. And if you didn't inventory once in a while, eventually you would go broke. I think all of us could probably agree with that statement. Now, his first comparison is this. In our lives, we have a business also. And our business in our lives is the business of being able to find a way where we can live peaceful, happy, and free, and be able to stay sober in the future. And if we don't inventory in our personal business and find the out-of-style, damaged, and unsaleable goods and get rid of them, then probably we're going to go broke too. And going broke for us is simply to go back to drinking. So whether we're dealing with a business inventory or a personal inventory, in either case, without it, we're going to go broke. Okay, now we're going to take a few key words out of the Big Book. We're going to put them on a picture and put them up here on the screen. And you have a copy of this in your handout material also. On one side of that sheet, we're going to put business inventory. The other side of that sheet, we're going to put personal inventory. We're going to take a few key words out of the Big Book and list them first under the business inventory. Now let's look and see what the book has to say. He says, taking a commercial inventory. Now that burned him. He could have said business again, couldn't he? But he don't like to use the same words twice in a row, so he'll call it commercial instead of business, meaning the same thing. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding. And we're putting fact-finding under the business. And a fact-facing process. We're putting fact-facing under business. It is an effort to discover the truth. And we're putting truth under business about the stock in trade. And we're putting stock in trade under business. The stock in trade, those are the things that we have in that store for sale. The ladies' purses, the men's watches, the bicycles, or whatever they are, that's the stock in trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods. We're putting damaged and unsaleable goods under business. to get rid of them promptly and without regret. And we're putting get rid of them promptly and without regret under business. In other words, we're going to find the stock in trade that is damaged, that we need to put on sale and get rid of. We need to move it out of the store completely. We're going to try to get rid of those things promptly and without regret. Now, we're listing the damaged and unsaleable goods. We're not listing the good ideas in stock. The good ideas, the good items, the good goods, they do not cause us to go broke. We make money on them every day. We're looking for the damaged and unsaleable goods. In other words, we're going to go on a fact-finding, fact-facing process. We're going to try to discover the truth about the stock in trade. We're looking for the damaged and unsaleable goods. When we find them, we're going to get rid of them promptly and without regret. Now, would anybody in here have any problem with that statement as far as a business inventory is concerned? Bill assumes we know a little something about a business and a business inventory. So he uses that as our example. Now then, he said, we did exactly the same thing with our lives. In other words, he wants us to do in our lives just exactly what he just told us to do in the business inventory. But rather than use the same words to tell us, he came up with a new series of words, which means basically the same thing. Step four says, we made a searching. And we're putting searching straight across from fact-finding. They mean basically the same thing. He said, we made a searching and fearless. We're putting fearless straight across from fact-facing. They basically mean the same thing, to fearlessly look at those facts. We made a searching and fearless moral. And there's where we got in trouble. We said, oh, shit, there it is. There's that list of dirty, filthy, nasty items. And we don't want to look at them ourselves, and we certainly don't want to share them with another human being later on in step five. Now, I'm really not sure what all Bill Wilson knew. But I know one thing. This guy understood the English language. And I really believe if he'd wanted us to make a list of dirty, filthy, nasty things, I believe he would have said we made a searching and fearless amoral or immoral inventory. And he didn't say that. He said moral. And it bugged us and bugged us and bugged us and bugged us till finally we went back to the dictionary. And we looked up the word moral. And one of the definitions of the word moral in the dictionary is truth. Things as they really are. The right and wrong of any given situation. So moral and truth means exactly the same thing. We made a searching and fearless moral inventory of what?
Ourselves.
Of ourselves. We're the only stock in trade that we have in this business to stand sober. Nobody else can make us sober. Nobody else can make us drink. Oh, I'll agree they can make us thirsty as hell once in a while, but they can't make us drink. We decide whether we drink or not. And what part of us decides whether we drink or not? Is it our mind or is it our body? The real problem, the alcoholic, centers in the mind rather than in the body. So as I make this searching and fearless moral inventory of myself, I'm going to look into my mind and I'm going to find the damaged and unsaleable goods, the flawed thinking processes, that block me off from the sunlight of the Spirit, that keep me from carrying out the decision I've made in step three. And I'm going to find those flawed thinking processes, and when I find them, I'm going to get rid of them promptly and without regret. Only then can God begin to direct my thinking. But as long as the flawed thinking processes, the damaged and unsaleable goods are in my mind, God is blocked out, and he simply cannot direct my thinking. Now, we've already talked about what those flawed thinking processes are. Resentment, fear, and the guilt and remorse associated with people we've harmed in the past. I like to look at my head up here as a little bitty store. Not very much. A little Quick Trip. Not even as big as a 7-Eleven.
Come and get it, maybe.
Saw one the other day, said, come and get it.
Little one.
Another one I saw said, come and go. Just a little bitty store. Not much in it. Now, up here on this side of my store, I've got some display cases, and they are filled with resentments. Damn him. Damn her. By God, I'll show them. Those SOBs aren't going to treat me that way. Blah-de-blah-de-blah-blah-blah-blah-blah-blah-blah. Those display cases are already full. There's no way God's thinking can enter those display cases. He is effectively blocked out. Over here at this side of my store, I've got a little file cabinet, and it's filled with fear. Oh, my God. What's she going to do when she finds out about this one? Oh, my God. What's the boss going to say? He told me next time he'd fire me. Oh, my God. What's the banker going to do? He's already told me the next time he'll fire. Oh, my God. Is that my car sitting out in the front of the house, in the front end of the store? I don't even know how. Oh, my God. And on and on and on and on and on. God can't get in that file cabinet. It's already filled with fears. He's very effectively blocked out. Back here in the back of my store, I have a little storage room, and it's filled with guilt and remorse associated with the harms I've done to people in the past. And it's so completely filled with guilt and remorse, God can't get in that storage room. He's very effectively blocked out. So if I want God to direct my thinking, I'm going to have to see the truth about these resentments, these fears, and this guilt and this remorse. And after I see the truth about them, I'm going to have to get rid of them. It's only when they are removed from my mind that God's thinking can enter my mind. And my book is getting ready to show me in a very simple way how to truthfully look at these things, how to remove them, and the greatest thing of all, how to keep them from coming back in the future. And if I can do that, then God can direct my thinking. If I don't do that, then the resentments and the fear and the guilt and remorse, they direct my thinking for me. Listen to what he says. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly, truthfully, morally. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways in what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From its stem, all forms of spiritual disease, for we've been not only spiritually sick, we've been not only mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. When a spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. So before we start setting the resentments on paper, maybe we better see if we fully understand what a resentment really is. Joe, what is a resentment?
A resentment is real simple. The word itself is self-explanatory. When we see that word re on the front of the word, re means again, like repeat, replay, redo, means again a second time. And sentire, that's a Latin word. Be careful with my soul Latin. I don't speak very good Latin.
Mid-Arkansas, soul Latin, too.
Okay. Now, sentire means to feel. So it means to feel again. And as we were talking in step three, which is the basis of life, basis of the personality, is self. It's God-given. And the basic instincts that make up self. You know, sometimes something happens, some people do something that strikes us. Strikes one part of self. Strikes our self-esteem, our security, and threatens our sex life. One part of self has to be threatened. And they call that's a wrong.
And people will do this. Remember, everybody has the same set of basic instincts.
They get sick.
Everybody overdoes. They get sick in those areas.
And they get sick, they'll strike you. For no reason at all, and that hurts. And that's the wrong on their part. That's not a resentment. Now, we alcoholics, we got bad problem with self. Everybody messes with it. We got a whole lot of self. So we're going to get a whole lot of resentment. Okay? You can look at us and hurt ourselves. Okay? Now, so we're struck, and that hurts. Now, we always have a bad habit. After we're hurt, we'll go back in the next room and we'll replay that again. You know, they had hit us but once, but we'll sit there and say, I was standing there just being nice. I don't know why I'm always nice when they're doing this. My halo's sticking out. And this mean person come up here and did this mean thing to me. And I play it over the second time. They didn't do it but one, but I played it the second time.
And we feel the pain the second time.
Feel the pain is deeper, right? And each time I play it over, it gets a little worse. I go home and from work and sit down. I said, I was sitting there doing nothing, being nice. And that person come up there. And in fact, I keep on playing, and in a few hours, it don't even resemble what really happened. But I ain't operating about the truth. I'm operating on what I think the truth is. But I have distorted it. And the more I play, the worse it gets. So, but the super thing about it, when I am playing this over, I'm allowing the person I'm mad at to control my life. That person is running my head rent-free. Okay. It's all like a football game. I use that illustration all the time. We watch football game, basketball game on now. And that guy goes under the basket and throws the ball up, and somebody reaches and grabs him and slams him down on the floor. And the old announcer said, ooh, did y'all see that? Boy, that really rough. Yeah.
Really got hurt.
He hurt. Look at him. And I saw some of it. I didn't see it too good. He said, look at that again. And he turns on his resentment machine. And he replays it over. This time he slows it down. He got it there. Slows it down where he can see. He got it living color. You can get all, you see the man's arm going the wrong way, the foot turned the wrong way. Real details. Yeah. Alcoholic gets up every morning, turns on his replay machine, cleans off the lens.
We got one of those machines right up here in our head now. Tune it up in living color.
He gets it ready, he knows what they're going to do. He's ready for trouble. And he goes out and shines it on the world all day long. Now, we don't want to record no good stuff. He just wants to record the bad stuff. Like 6 o'clock news, He records all that bad stuff, come home, plays it, makes himself sick, and blames it on them. That's the stupidity of it. Now, some days he has a bad day. Now, a bad day is when they won't do nothing to him. That's a bad day.
It's a bad day for an alcoholic.
You know what he does on those days? He records what they're thinking. You know, resentment is the number one offender destroyed. It's totally a way to be completely unhappy. It brings on one of the worst emotional illnesses, is self-pity, self-resentment. As soon as we resent another person for what they did to us, then we resent our position in life where that could have even happened. That's self-resentment. That's why we got two patterns of it. If we ain't in one, we're in another one. We usually got a dominant thing in a sick alcoholic's life. A Oh, we got a lot of resentments and a lot of anger. So, you know, God can't direct our lives. Well, our lives are being directed by everybody else that we're mad at. So, if we want this decision to be carried out, we got these resentments must go.
You know, one bad thing about a resentment is you throw it out there long enough. After a while, it's going to turn right around and come right back at you. And when it comes right back at you, it comes back as self-resentment. And we begin then to resent ourselves for being in a position to have those things happen to us. We can't stand self-resentment. So after a while, self-resentment turns into self-pity. And this is one of the sickest things a human being can have. And we alcoholics love self-pity. We love to get up in the morning, get prepared for work, and as we go out the door, we put self-pity on as a cloak of dignity, and we say, "Here we come, mean old world. I know you're out there going to get me, and you're going to do it to me again today. This sure is hell." If you don't think an alcoholic loves self-pity, you try to feel sorry for one of us. And we'll tell you in a hurry, "Don't you feel sorry for us. By God, that's our business." Now, is there any way that God can enter a mind filled with that kind of crap? There's no way that He can. So the damage and unsaleable goods called resentment is going to have to be removed from our minds before God can begin to direct our thinking.
Once you get a resentment mind, you don't just get resentment at one thing. You're resentful everywhere, at everybody, at everything. It kind of takes hold of your whole being.
Even the weather.
Even the weather, yeah. Just the weather.
Now, one of our troubles with this inventory is the example that's used on page 65 is already completed. Mm-hmm. And we didn't understand or know the procedure that Bill followed in order to fill that sheet out. So what we've done is we've made you an inventory sheet. And on your inventory sheet, you will find five columns. We would ask you now to fold the last two under or cover them up where you can't even see them. And if you'll do that, you'll be looking at columns 1, 2, and 3. And we want to emphasize, we're not trying to bring another inventory into AA. We've got enough of those already. Those three columns that you have in front of you is nothing more than page 65 in the blank form. Column 1 says, "I'm resentful at." Column 2 says, "The cause." Column 3 says, "Affects mine." Now let's go back to the bottom of page 64. And let's see if we can't see the simple little instructions on how to fill out this inventory sheet. Joe?
Yeah, it says when the spiritual malady is overcome, and of course a spiritual malady is not only our relationship with God, as important as that is, but our own spiritual being. When the spiritual malady of our own spiritual being is straightened out, we straighten out mentally and physically. If you look at page 65 briefly, you'll see that we're taught to read from left to right in school. If you start reading from left to right in school, in page 65, as I did, trying to figure out what they wanted me to do, I looked at Mr. Brown there. Yeah, okay. I changed my thinking, and I went to the second column. Well, the cause, here's attention to my wife and some other things. What part of self was affected? And I wrote down some of the parts of self that were, or looked at some of the parts of self that was affected. Didn't quite understand what self meant yet. Then I skipped and changed my mind again to Miss Jones. Just changed my mind again, went to the second column. Changed my mind again, went to the third column. Now, if you do that a little while, your mind just kind of goes blank. Bingo. I mean, whatever happens. And you say to yourself, as I did, all the hell with it, they don't want that anyhow. What they want is all my life story, really. So I just skip over that. Well, now, if we look at the instructions on bottom page 64, they're very short and very sweet. He said, in dealing with resentment, we set them on paper.
We've got the paper. Let's look at the instructions.
Now,
period, stop.
Period, stop. Now, we believe, or at least I do, that we're to fill out these columns one at a time, top to bottom, rather than left to right. You see, so we take the first column. Indeed, if we recently set them on paper, first column, we listed people, institution, or principal with whom we are angry, period.
Period.
We stop right there, going from top to bottom, while we have our mind on one thing and one thing only, the people, the institutions, and principals whom we're angry, and we write them down. Now, we all know who we're mad at. All you got to do is remember what you think about in the middle of the night, and who you think about in the middle of the night, and what you think about in the middle of the night, and how you're going to get even with those people in the middle of the night. And you write them down. So, and leaving a little bit of space between the names, because this space will come in handy so we can fill out the second column. So we listed the people. We know who the people are, who has offended us, and how we think about them. We think about the institutions, which could be the post office or FedEx or Internal Revenue Service or just whoever that's bothering you and bugging us. And then we start looking at the principles. Principles used to bug hell out of me all the time. I didn't like certain principles. You know, my mother and daddy used to tell me, he said, son, if you lay down with dogs, you're going to get up with fleas. Well, I hated that. You're going to run with these thieves, and you're going to be a thief. And I didn't like that either. And what you give out, you get back. I didn't like those kind of principles. So I wrote down all these people, institutions, and principles with whom we were angry, first column at a time, top to bottom, leaving a little bit of space between each one.
What could be more simple than to start at the top of that column, make a list of all the people we're upset with, all the institutions we're upset with, all the principals we're upset with? I've never known an alcoholic yet that did not know just exactly who and what, by God, we're mad at. We sit around for hours talking about it in bars. All we go to do is take it out of our head, put it down on a sheet of paper, going top to bottom. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I know about me. They came to me and they said, make a list of your resentments. And I said, I don't have any. They said, oh, surely you do. Maybe you don't understand what a resentment is. Let us explain it to you. And they explained to me that it was refilling the old hurts and angers and pains. And I said, oh, yeah, I've got a couple of those. They said, okay, put it down on a sheet of paper. So I put down a couple of names, and the next thing you know, I put down three, and then four, and then five. And just a little bit, I had about eight names listed on that sheet of paper, leaving some space in between the names, as Bill did here on page 65. I reached over and I got another sheet of paper. The next thing you know, I'd listed eight more, and I reached over and got another sheet of paper. The next thing you know, I'd listed eight more, and I reached over and got another sheet of paper. I got up to about 152. And I said, man, you matter than hell at everybody. I did not know that. You can only see one resentment at a time in your head. I don't think any of us will ever realize how many resentments we really do have until we put them all down on paper and see them in their entirety for the first time. Now, if I've made a decision in step three to let God direct my thinking, and I've got that many resentments, then those resentments are directing my thinking and God can't. It's just that simple.